Let's make the term challenging children a thing of the past. Today's guest, Sally Galloway, believes that early childhood education and care settings have a once-in-a-generation opportunity to change the trajectory of children's health and well-being. With over 14 years of invaluable experience as a pediatric occupational therapist, she is renowned for her unwavering passion for early education advocacy, expertise in child development, and steadfast commitment to inclusive practices. And can I just say, Sally Galloway, oh my goodness, I am so excited to have you on board today.
Thank you, Chrissy. What an intro.
I know. I'm going off with big impact because that's how we're going to create the wave of change that is so desperately needed. We are not hiding behind closed doors anymore. We are busting those doors open, and we on the Child Trauma Podcast, we are tackling some big topics. And you and I were chatting off air about, for me, how excited I am now that there's people like you out there that are championing and speaking my language, because I feel like I have sometimes carried a very big responsibility and weight on my shoulders. And it is so refreshing to hear that you are also out there creating waves and working your butt off like me to improve the lives, not only for children, but for our early years educators. So why don't you kick it off a little bit and tell us about how you landed in your role as an early educational OT?
Thanks, Chrissy. I absolutely love it. And I'm so glad that I am here fighting the good fight with you.
Oh, it's a tough gig, babe. I know, but we're still going. So,
So I guess I've named myself your early education OT, and I graduated in 2009 as an occupational therapist and got my first job then, and just ended up in a long day care environment in an early intervention service for children with autism. That's how it was named at the time. And it was in this long daycare environment. And in this process, I really saw the power of working collaboratively with my colleagues. So there's speech pathologist, teacher, early childhood educators, and we truly worked in a transdisciplinary model supporting children.
Love that.
And families. And it was a setting not like a traditional OT setting where you would have a client come in, et cetera. You were on the floor, on the ground, within ratio for the duration of the time that the children were in the service. So after leaving that role and working in different settings, I just found that there was nowhere quite like that environment that made that difference, that daily difference in the lives of the children and educators through really simple practices. So I would have children come in and see me once a week or once a fortnight. And I would try and impart my knowledge as much as I could in that process and collaborate with the families and their teachers and things like that. But there was nothing quite like, you know, really supporting in that everyday environment through those micro moments that really made a difference. So So I sort of landed back in early education and care, ended in a national manager role for an early childhood service in Australia. And then after that, moved into my own consultancy doing this work.
Amazing. And I love that on the ground, as I call it, or in the grind with the kids and the teachers is the only way forward, right? We can't keep supporting kids with regulation, which is going to be the theme of our topic today, regulation rituals and why they're so important. We can't continue to keep teaching our kids regulation strategies outside of the environment that is causing them to be dysregulated. I don't know how many more times I can say that until I'm blue in the face.
That's 100% it. And that's what, like, occupational therapy, like as an occupational therapist, that's what we always talk about. It's this environmental, like it, the individual, the environment, and the task, that just right fit between all of those. So, you know, a child may be able to engage and do a specific activity in a clinic setting, but take them to an environment that's unpredictable, managing lots of different personalities and emotions and all the things and expectation, and suddenly that activity or task becomes too difficult to even
comprehend. I can even remember taking my daughter to Speechy when she got picked up in kinder for some communication deficits, if we want to call them that horrible word, and she just went mute in the session. And in the end, the speech, she was amazing. She just gave me all the activities and I just did them at home. Being a teacher, obviously I had the confidence to do that. And we smashed them out, and she, you know, we disengaged from that service really quickly. But that was a really interesting viewpoint for me as a parent, seeing her high masking in that environment where I was sitting there going, why aren't you talking? Come on, you don't shut up at home, you know? So different environments can present different behaviors for different children. Let's just put that on the table. So let's come to the words. We hear the words, I think, feel like they're really big buzzwords at the moment out there in the work that we're doing. We hear the words regulation and dysregulation a lot. So let's just break it down for people. But let's start with regulated and then we'll move to dysregulated. What does that actually mean?
Well, I'll give you my explanation and I'd love to hear how you describe it too. But, you know, people think that regulation is like this straight line, this straight band, like we're in this zen, calm state all the time. And that, you know, whatever comes our way, we're not necessarily going to respond to that in a like angry way or a emotional way or whatever it might be. But that's not what it is at all. Like when we think about regulation, what I'm doing with my hands, it's more like a wave, you know. So when we're thinking about being regulated, it means that we've got some give. It's kind of like an elastic band, right, that you can sort of pull and let go depending on the stresses that are put upon you throughout the day and throughout the task. So it means that you can, you know, come up against something that might be new or tricky, and you have enough stretch that you can, even though you don't know it or you find it difficult, you can stretch yourself just enough to get your needs met in that moment without, you know, necessarily the full explosion.
We call that our window of tolerance, don't
that's
we?
That's right.
If we think about the fact that we are, as human beings, we are fundamentally fueled by emotion, which means that on any given day, depending on our environment or what we've got planned, that we can experience, like you said, a wave of different emotions at various points throughout the day. And everybody's window of tolerance, I mean, let's take driving in traffic as a good example. There are some people who can navigate city traffic, like me, do a hook turn, without even raising a sweat. Yet there are other people who might encounter that situation and be so distressed or overwhelmed that that will cause a, you know, emotional response or visceral reaction in their body, right? Depending on your own experiences or you know, different things that you've lived through. If we're talking about kids, that maybe a child has been in that certain situation before or encountered some of those challenges before, then their window of tolerance is going to be greater than a child who maybe hasn't experienced that before, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And it also depends, it can change daily or, you know, in the moment, depending on how many things you've been, you know, how much you've slept the night before. Like, you know, if we put yourself in that same position doing that hook turn when you had a newborn baby in the car screaming, maybe you wouldn't have found that as easy, you know, to navigate. So it also is dependent on those external factors that come into play at times as well. Again, why I think it's so important from an environmental perspective, because in a really like calm, planned environment that like a therapy setting as an example where it's just one-on-one.
Contained.
Yeah, it's contained. And so, you know, therapists might not ever see this dysregulation occur, right? Like we're able to really stay in this regulated state. But then you go into an early learning environment or a school environment.
I was just about to say, classrooms are not contained, people.
Yes,
they are so right. Busy, so much movement, so much unpredictability, so much yes. Noise, so many social interactions, all the things.
Yes.
Which then leads us to experience, can lead us to experiencing dysregulation.
That's right.
Right. So what would you talk to about that?
So then the dysregulation is where you would be outside of that window of tolerance. So it would be, you would, you know, be particularly over responsive to what has occurred. And then that, like the reaction is far too big for what you would think would be the reaction for that situation. Mm-hmm. So that might be where we see like a child who does end up pushing a peer or
yes.
becoming overly frustrated, or it can that dysregulation can also look like we completely shut down from that experience, right? Mm-hmm. And are unable to engage and to be able to participate meaningfully in the activity.
And I think, because a lot of teachers say to me there was no trigger, there was seemingly no trigger. It was such a big reaction. And I think that's why I wanted to have this conversation, because kids can be dysregulated and still look calm, right?
Yes.
So, and there are so many different signs to regulation or little cues that our kids give us, that it's often that if we do get that big escalation or dangerous behavior or anything physical that seemingly has come from nowhere, it generally means that that kid actually has been dysregulated. We just haven't known about it, right?
That's right.
So it's really good that we have that perspective. Now, I know you're doing a lot of work in early education, and the core of my work has been in primary school settings. I've taught from prep to up to year 9.
Yep.
But what, and I think one of the challenges that we're going to talk about of what you're seeing is, you know, when we're working in an early education setting, dysregulated children or big feelings or big emotions or meltdowns or tantrums, whatever we want to call them, which is basically just, as I call them, stress responses. We just put a caveat across all of those things.
All of the above. Yes.
All of the above.
Yes.
It's still considered, you know, developmentally appropriate because of the underdeveloped brain.
Yes.
Right, which doesn't necessarily make it easy. I always, you know, I'd still do a lot of PD in early education, and I do believe that this is one of the most difficult cohorts because, you know, there's a lot going on developmentally for these kids, and it is also a point of often early diagnosis for kids who possibly are neurodivergent, and so you know they're navigating a lot of big emotions from these kids.
Yeah.
But what would you say if, and so I guess talk to a little bit about that, you know, because 6 seems to be the magic number, doesn't it? You know, that once kids have hit primary school or formal learning, then we can talk about a diagnosis, or is there something else going on? Or, you know what I mean? Like, why is 6 the magic number? Because there's plenty of kids in primary school that are still really struggling with emotional regulation or dysregulation, I should say, and needing a lot of support from the educators to get them back down to that baseline.
Yeah. I think it's really interesting you say that, because a big piece of the work I do in early childhood, and I find really, really helpful, is just understanding that idea around like the chronological age versus developmental age. And, you know, it is actually, it's quite surprising sometimes when you are talking to individuals about, you know, the difference between those two and what they mean and reflect, that this still is fairly new terminology to some people, right, in the space. And so even just understanding that, whilst a child, like chronologically from the day they were born to the day it is now, is like 6 years old, developmentally, you know, where we might be, you know, meeting, like we have lagging skills, right? And so when we're thinking about, you know, where we're at and how we can best support children. And we can find, like in occupational therapy, we always talk about the just right fit, you know, where we find an activity that's just like it's meeting, like that they can achieve, but it's stretching them just that much outside of their comfort zone to have that sort of skill acquisition. Understanding, you know, where they are from that perspective is really, really helpful to, you know, extend them that way. And I think that that continues, right? We can't, you know, when we start to support children or to teach children at a level that they're not yet at, you know, we get the children start to disengage. They feel, you know, stupid or what's the point? Like it's easier to.
Well, they're not cognitively able to onboard what we're trying to teach, right?
That's right.
I feel like that's a really big part of the work that I do when I'm educating parents, is that about, you know, especially, and we know that the prefrontal cortex doesn't come online until around the age of 8, I think the research is saying now, which is about grade 3-4 people. Mm-hmm. And that our expectations around what children are should be cognitively able to onboard. It's just like the piece of the brain that actually allows that, guys, is not even there yet, which is once again why working in early childhood is incredibly difficult, because that's why it feels like Groundhog Day. Here we go again. We're having the same conversations. I just told you that yesterday. Why aren't you getting it? And that's why, because it's not getting in, Mrs. Marsh. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
And it is that repetition and looking at other ways of trying to teach regulation skills rather than just talking, which is, you know, why I've written books and created all the resources, and I'm sure you do that, you know, all the breathing activities and all that sort of stuff. But the reality is kids can't access any of those skills when their brain is offline.
That's right.
Right? So our number one job, and what the research sort of tells us, is that kids cannot learn to self-regulate if they are not taught or able to sit with someone who has a regulated nervous system through co-regulation and safe attachments.
Yes. And I think like you've hit the nail on the head there, right? Which I'm, and that is fundamentally the work that I have been doing in this space as well. It's focusing on ourselves and how we are actually able to be. But there has been such an increase, like since the pandemic, absolutely, since the pandemic, I have seen, and my work in services have absolutely seen, more and more educators feeling like there are more and more children who are experiencing difficulties in the space, finding it really difficult to engage and to have friendships and to learn, even in the early childhood space, and lots of concern around, are they ready? You know, will they be ready for school, right?
And can I just pause there? Because what we're talking about here is the impacts of trauma.
Yes.
So please go back and listen to the conversation earlier in the series, which I had with Rebecca Harris from Embedding Wellbeing, about the impacts of trauma. It doesn't just go away, people. We can't just live through a pandemic and have children born into that stressful environment and expect that it's just all of a sudden magically going to heal itself. We've got to go back as parents and help our children move through that trauma and release some of the trauma that is being stored in their body. And there are so many different ways we can do that. Animal therapy, play therapy, sand therapy, water therapy, you know, or it's not about talk therapy for kids at that age as well. But putting these kids in educational environments and then expecting teachers to do all the healing work, yes, they are part of the process, but they can't be the only part, right?
But when you think about it, like my son, he was born in 2019, in September 2019, and I live in Queensland, and so our restrictions and things like that were quite different, right? But all of my family, as an example, live in Victoria, in Geelong, and my husband's family are in New South Wales. And so the impact, so when you think about that from an attachment perspective, like I was his primary attachment figure, but I was quickly becoming very burnt out in that space, right? And I was also full of fear. of what was happening in the world, and the way in which I was able to be responsive, right, was different to the responsiveness I was able to give to my daughter. And so when we're thinking even about, and also, sorry, think about early education and care environments. And I was in a national manager role at that time, and I had several therapists in Victorian centres. And so, you know, those services, our educators had to wear masks. They were trying to keep social distancing from the children.
Almost impossible with a three-year-old.
Which is almost impossible, but they were, it created this response where educators were actually fearful of children, from not from the child's perspective, but that they would get COVID. And so you just think about that from that attachment perspective of how that would have impacted like ongoing, right? Yeah. Of, you know, so when we're seeing children having difficulties in connecting now, so my son now, he's in kindy, he's 4-year-old kindy, the year before school. And so he, you know, just seeing that cohort going through, it is very different to seeing the cohort that went through with my daughter, and the relation just within the relationships and the secure attachments and connections. And so we are seeing more of, you know, a greater need for more big body movements and indoor outdoor play.
It's about acknowledging that, Sal. It's like, yeah, it's actually acknowledging it for what it is. It's nobody's fault. It was a pandemic that nobody was prepared for. But I think this is, you know, one of the fundamental shifts, and part of why I want to have this conversation too, is that it's teachers are being expected to be across some of this stuff, or to know how to process trauma, or do you know what I mean? And it's so unfair for them to be having to be across all of this stuff without any proper training or education around that, and to be able then being in classrooms, like you said, with all these kids with massive emotions.
Yes.
And, you know, talk a little bit about what we're talking about off air, about how that's actually really scary for educators. If you're new to working in early childhood or education, and all of a sudden you've got a child blowing up a classroom because they're dysregulated, I mean, that's the extreme end, right?
Yeah, but that's happening.
Yes, it's happening. I know it's happening. It's why teachers are leaving, right?
Yeah, and it's it's 3- and 4-year-old children that, you know, educators are feeling legitimately scared to be around, like due to the responses that they're having, that they're, you know, the flipping the tables, the spitting on them, the biting, the all those sorts of outward behaviours that you know we're seeing, and then we're seeing more and more disengaged educators too, right? Like I know in the services I'm working in at the moment, you know, that you have your 1, 2, 3 real champions in the service who, you know, absolutely understand how important all of this work is and are trying to be the champion in the service. And then there are, you know, other teachers and educators who are finding that a lot more difficult. Like, how do I engage back in? How do I be present? But I think it's that whole stress. It's been, it's just continued, right? Mm. And it's continued in the sector from COVID, from being in that really stressful situation that I just described before. And it's still continued now, because now we have the financial fallout of that situation. And then we have, all the things that are going on, which is limiting educators' ability to come and be available, emotionally available to children, right? Because there's too much other stuff going on. Yeah. And so then we're wondering why we've got all of this dysregulation happening. Mm-hmm. And when you really look at it from an outsider's point of view, there's not as much connection happening. And also children need to connect in different ways than they did previously as well, many of the children, right? Because they didn't have as much physical touch. They didn't have all of those things in the early years. And, you know, that's shifted what they need now in the kindergarten space.
And, you know, one of my favourite sayings is can't keep doing the same things and expecting a different outcome.
Yeah, that's right.
It just doesn't work like that, does it, my friend?
Yeah.
And so
no.
One of the things we really wanted to hit on is, okay, we know we've got this problem, shall we call it, for lack of a better word.
Yeah.
We know we've got these teachers out there who are really, you know, trying so hard to provide that relational safety and be that safe base for these kids.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I love about the work you're doing is something that you've called regulation rituals.
Yes.
In trauma-informed practices, we talk a lot about how important setting kids up, whether they've come from adversity or whether they're carrying trauma, unprocessed trauma, or whether they've just had a blow up with their mum.
Yeah.
Maybe talking from personal experience here, guys, about the reader in the morning. And then we pack them off into the car and we send them off into the classroom carrying all those big emotions, and we just hand them over and say, see you at 3:10 or 3:30. Is how can we incorporate what you beautifully call regulation rituals into the way that we set children up for success every single day?
Yeah. So regulation rituals has really come from my observations in this space and exactly what you're talking about. And there's that beautiful metaphor, the rowboat metaphor, that I'm sure you would
Tell it to everybody in case they don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, but now I won't say it right. So, but it's this idea.
It's a bit like who sank the boat, you know?
Yeah, who sank the boat, yeah. But it's this idea of, you know, transferring attachment, right? Like transferring a connection. And so there's such a big piece around when we're moving from one environment to the next environment, from that secure attachment figure. So from
your mum who's just yelled at you for not doing the mom. Reader again.
Yeah. And whilst you may, yes, exactly. And then the ability, even at that moment, like even if that child has become dysregulated there, if you have that other human who has the secure attachment able to come and connect with the child, right? And reestablish that connection through like a calming ritual together that they do together, that can completely recenter and restart that day. And I know off air we were talking about like how valuable like a connection time or a, I know my son's kindy calls it a connection time, and I love that for you know, a welcome circle or a group time. The way in which they always talk about it is this connection time, and I think it's so beautiful because that is the whole point of coming together. It's to reconnect, to you be able to utilize some of the strategies you were talking about before, about body scanning or who, you know, the acknowledgement and the welcome of who is here today and where we're at. So we can absolutely read the room and then, you know, decipher where do we go to next, depending on the levels the children are coming
and
at.
And our school beautifully does morning circle, which I love. Yes. I mean, you can call it whatever you want. It's basically a morning check-in. And it is, I think, just an integral tool that all schools should be doing across the board. That's as right. A way of, first and foremost, identifying which kids in their classroom are feeling safe to learn, ready to learn, which is a big part of the Berry Street educational model, scanning the environment to seeing who may be a little bit dysregulated and who you can very swiftly make your way over to for a bit of co-regulation. But it's also an incredible way for kids who may be experiencing some anxiety, or if they do come from adverse childhood experiences, or they have had a blowout with mum in the car on the way in. It's also safe, predictable, and low cognitive load, right?
That's
which
right.
means that kids are not expected to do anything or be anyone yet until we've got their brain in a safe space, ready to learn or on board the transition or the activity or whatever it might be, right?
That's right. And thinking of like my lens is early childhood, there are so many moments throughout the day and more like really micro moments throughout the day that I was talking about to implement these regulation rituals, things that are, you know, predictable, that happen at a certain time that children know that they're going to occur. And that transform really like an everyday routine into something a lot more meaningful that has from that ritual perspective, a lot more rich and joyful, and bring the children into that situation. So we're really transforming, what we can just think about as a routine moving from here to there, because it's lunchtime now and we're going to do that, to something that actually has all of those connection and recentering properties, right? To regulate oneself and to connect back in, especially when you're coming from, a class or like the outdoor environment where it's been free play, it's been quite overwhelming, quite dysregulating from what you've had to navigate in that situation. All of those moments that you can come back in and connect, that's what I'm, referring to when I'm thinking.
I'm actually thinking about, I think it was my suggestion, but I'm thinking I'm tracking back to early childhood with my little guy as well.
And yeah.
Drop-offs were, tricky with a child with adverse childhood experience background. And one of the things that we did for a regulation ritual was every single morning he got to water the plants.
Yes.
And so as soon as we'd hit the ground, the educator would come in. She'd be like, "Good morning, mate. Here is your watering jug." And off he'd go around watering the plants. And it was such a beautiful regulation ritual, one that involved movement. Two, he loves plants, loves water, loves helping, all those nature, all those things, tick, 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 tick. And we changed it up because, ADHD, he would have got bored with that eventually. And then once that establishment or felt safety was there, he didn't need that on drop-off anymore.
That's right.
But I think I'm even thinking about sometimes with my son in particular, if there's been a long weekend or like, next week we're going away, our school's got a curriculum day and we're taking the Thursday off, and then Monday's the public holiday. So it's going to be 5 days until he sees his teacher.
Right.
There has to be some kind of positive primer or regulation ritual when he comes back, because for my son, 5 days away from the classroom is like an eternity, right? And often I'm thinking about teachers who might be listening to this as well. One of the other things that I do is, on a Monday morning, I'll always just do a very quick email about what we got up to.
Yes.
So that then the teacher has got a point of connection to very quickly reestablish that, that regulation and relational safety. And
That's right.
That is such a subtle but simple thing we can do for our
kids. It's so powerful. Yeah. Absolutely. And I think that was one thing I wanted to touch on in this conversation, was just how much, one of the things I was talking about is, one of the, what would I want educators and teachers to know, and parents to know about this space. And it is exactly what you've described, this power of collaboration. I've found sometimes it can feel like us and them sort of scenario when we're talking about the best interests of our child and trying to understand what's how we can best support the children in the learning environment and also best support children in the home. But knowing that, it is from my experience that everyone has the absolute best intent for the child. There might be one or two, who may not, but apart from that, it is the majority, right?
We love teachers on this podcast.
Yeah, that's absolutely it. And it's like, how do we open those communication channels? Like, how do we have those collaborative conversations? How do we create small moments to transfer that knowledge of what has happened at home to school or kindy, and the other way around, right? Where we're not talking in front of the child.
Totally.
And but we're able to transfer.
I'm laughing, but I'm thinking about it a couple of years ago when things were really hectic when we first started at our new school. But I would literally just send a quick email, batten the hatches, to my kids' teacher, and she'd be like, "We'll be ready." Do you know what I mean? Because it's almost like they're coming in block. We're sending our kids in with these huge emotions, and teachers are like, "Oh, what's going on?" And, one of the first things teachers will say is, "Did anything happen at home?" Some days, no, nothing has happened at home. And many neurodivergent kids, we say, coming back to drawing on that window of tolerance that we're talking about, that they wake up on a 7.
Yes.
So there's only 3 touch points until they blow,
Yeah.
So
yeah.
The bandwidth is can be very narrow for some of these kids, which is why, you know, we as parents try to make that commitment of ensuring most of the time that we can get our kids to school regulated and ready to learn. But, you know, we always know that, you know, like we said before, the fluctuation and the variance on that is we just never know which way it's going to go. So, and I think the key takeaway as well from this conversation is, especially just drawing back to your last point, is being on the same page and all working together.
Yes.
And it's, you know, not nobody's fault that a child is experiencing distress. It's like, okay, well, what are we all going to do about it?
That's right.
You know,
and I actually love how you brought in humor to that, like the batten down the hatches type comment. Like, it actually brings joy and humor.
He's coming, baby. He's coming whether you like it or not. So get ready, you know.
Because it can be hard and it can be heavy for everyone, right? Like at times, supporting, you know, children who are experiencing challenges in that space. And like lifting the energy through that is it actually works wonders for the attachment for the teacher and the child, right?
Okay, can I just say on that? Sorry to cut you off. Let's just you and I could talk all day, and one of our goals was to try and keep this under half an hour, so we'll wrap it up. But even things like, you know, having goals for kids around emotional regulation, or I can remember reading a certain reduced timetable plan for a little mate that I've been working with, which we advocated against, because when you actually understand fluctuation and dysregulation in kids, it often they actually don't have cognitive control over it. Like you were saying, it's unpredictable. We don't know when. Often we can try to reduce the environment and the sensory overload and all that sort of stuff. But one of the things on the contract that we were supposed to sign was that this child would display 2 full weeks without dysregulation or meltdowns or whatever.
Yeah.
And I just went back to them and just said, this is not neuroaffirming.
Yeah.
And also, we cannot keep a child outside of their learning community because of what might happen.
That's right. 100%. Yeah.
Every single day, we allow these kids the best opportunity that they can. We wrap around them if the wheels fall off, and we support using those therapeutic approaches, co-regulation, you know, all the breathing strategies. And then know that tomorrow is a new day.
That's
you
right.
know,
that is
and
right.
Tomorrow they may come to school and not experience dysregulation, and you might be looking at a completely different child.
That's right.
And yay for them on that day, right?
Yes.
So, you know, so these are some of the big shifts that I keep on championing for in education for kids who do live with nervous system disabilities, especially, is a big core of my work. But you know, when we look at behavior as a stress response, that underneath all that aggression or flipping chairs or whatever is actually a child who is crying out for support.
That's it.
And doesn't that give us more empathy, don't you think, when you look at it that way?
Oh yeah, 100%. Every time I'm in that, you know, position and supporting educators through challenging situations like that, when we are able to reflect or even just talk about, well, what might have occurred before, you know, or what does their family home look like, what is going on? Yeah, you just suddenly come from a place of compassion and truly believing, you know, that, what is it, like irrational positive intent, you know, like we just, that's not what it is, but, you know, like we're a positive regard, like just assuming that everyone is doing the best that they possibly can. And that is the same, you know, for the children.
And one of my all-time favorites is compassion over compliance.
Yeah.
You know.
Right.
So if any amazing humans are listening to this gorgeous conversation and you're about to launch your regulation rituals course, tell us where people can find that, and I'll link it in the show notes, obviously, so if people want to go and check it out.
Yeah, so that launches next week, depends when this podcast goes live. So that would be the 11th of June, and you can just find me at sallygalloway.com.au.
Okay,
So I can, amazing. Give you that link and go from there.
Thank you so much.
No, thank you so much for the conversation. It's been fantastic.
Yeah, it has. And I hope that it really inspires and all the other amazing teachers out there who we know are really, you know, really, really trying to do the best that they can with the knowledge that they have. So
100%.
let's keep championing for those kids and let's stop calling them challenging.
Yes.
And change the narrative around that. So thank you so much, Sal.
Thank you, Chrissy.
Well, gang, that concludes another amazing episode of the Child Charmer podcast. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you truly love the conversation just as much as me. I'd be so flipping grateful if you took the time to like or share this episode, or even better, leave me a review. Make sure you also subscribe so that you don't miss a thing. Come on over and join me on my Instagram page at Chrissy Chaos to Calm, where I am sharing daily snippets of my life, work, and play, and where I have built the most amazing supportive community, where I am always encouraging them to